lecture this evening is on Primo Levi's book, This Is a Man. We're going to be reading out quite a lot of extracts from the book, and we're going to give page numbers. So if you've got your copy with you, you might want to get it out and put it on the desk. But if not, don't worry, because it will be fairly self-explanatory. And I'm very grateful to Nick Collins, who's come along to read the extracts for me, because there are a lot of them. And I suppose the first thing I should say is that I consider it a great honour to give this lecture, and I'm grateful to Jeremy for asking me to give it. But I also think that it's a text in a way that one has to lecture on in a slightly different way. That in a sense, talking about this text is more an act of commemoration than a piece of literary criticism. And I will make one or two remarks about how this book is constructed and about some of its qualities as a piece of writing. But of course, my main concern throughout this talk is the subject matter and the discoveries which Levi makes in the course of the book. If This Is a Man is one of the most important books of the 20th century. It's a book that everyone in Europe should read. If your parents haven't read it, make them read it when you're finished with it. But I think you have to look at reading it as a sort of moral duty, as much as a question of exercising your critical faculties. I'd like to start the lecture by looking at Levi's position in the book. The book presents itself as a very simple, natural narrative. In fact, it's a highly crafted book, which took Levi many revisions. It took Levi many revisions to make the book seem as simple and as straightforward as it does. Part of the reason for this is the genre in which, in spite of himself, Levi is writing in. The problem is that prison narratives always have a way of turning into adventure stories. How I Have the Resourcefulness to Survive. Levi absolutely does not want that to happen. This is a story about him and about his friends, in the sense that they are witnesses, in the sense that everything he says is observed by him and is clearly true to the best of his ability to present it. He carefully says nothing about things which he can infer, things which are also facts, but which he himself did not see. The point is, in other words, to be a witness, not to be the hero. And the danger of a prison narrative is that you're always about to be the hero in some sort of an adventure story about your survival. Levi's position in this book is that of a dispassionate witness, presenting the facts as he sees them for the reader's judgment. As he says in the afterword on page 382, when describing the tragic world of Auschwitz, I have deliberately assumed the calm, sober language of the witness. He says repeatedly that he has performed the task of the witness and that he's been preparing the ground for the judge who is, of course, the reader. At the same time, he makes it clear what his judgment is. Only those who repented fully and quickly can be forgiven. All the rest of those who knew what was going on and allowed it must be condemned. Besides this stance as witness, though, he also takes a slightly different stance, that of the moralist, the inquirer, the detached observer of a terrible experiment. He writes as if the death camps tell us terrible lessons about human nature and about the nature of life in bodies and in societies. I'm going to develop that point in a minute, but I just want to say a word about the title, If This Is a Man, a title which in the English translation is accurate to the Italian title. In translations that are published in other parts of the English-speaking world, they use other titles. What's the meaning of this title, If This Is a Man? I think there are about at least three things concealed in this phrase. In one part, it's a sort of question. It's a question, are these people men? That is, are the prisoners men? Are the guards men? Are the commandants men? That's a question implied, but not actually stated. So there's a kind of ambiguity about this as well. Which man are we referring to at different points in the story? But I want to insist, the question is implied, not stated. What is stated is the first part of a logical argument. If this is a man, that's the end of the title, but the implied sentence would go on, then humanity is, etc., etc. It's what we call a hypothetical syllogism. You know, if you say, if the sun has risen, then it's day. You make many arguments in that form. And if this is a man is a way of saying, what can we infer about humanity if this is a man? So it may or may not be a man. That's also part of the question. But if it is a man, then it leads to questions about the nature of humanity. Now, I want to illustrate this idea that the book is describing general lessons about human nature from the death camps with an example. And the example is on page 23. And he shows us that in a way the death camps are teaching a lesson or concluding a lesson that one might learn elsewhere in life. So, Nick.
Sooner or later in life, everyone discovers that perfect happiness is unrealizable. But there are few who pause to consider the antithesis, that perfect unhappiness is equally unattainable. The obstacles preventing the realization of both these extreme states are of the same nature. They derive from our human condition, which is opposed to everything infinite. Our ever insufficient knowledge of the future opposes it, and this is called, in the one instance, hope, and in the other, uncertainty of the following day. The certainty of death opposes it, for it places a limit on every joy, but also on every grief. The inevitable material cares oppose it, for as they poison every lasting happiness, they equally assiduously distract us from our misfortunes and make our consciousness of them intermittent and hence supportable. It was the very discomfort, the blows, the cold, the thirst that kept us aloft in the void of bottomless despair, both during the journey and after. It was not the will to live, nor a conscious resignation, for few are the men capable of such resolution, and we were but a common sample of humanity.
This is a crucial point that he makes, in other words. Having a body which has limitations, having a body which is thirsty and hungry and cold, keeps you out of despair. You know, just as the nature of human life is that there's no perfect happiness, what you must also learn is that the nature of human life is there's no complete unhappiness. And even at that moment when one would think that people could be as unhappy as it was possible to be, their very deprivations were what kept them afloat. And Levy presents this, I think fairly and justly, as a kind of discovery about human nature, which reflects experience outside the camps, but which gains a special resonance from the camps. And the point he goes on to make is, this isn't a question of virtue or heroism. This is a question of the nature of the organism. The fact that you have these wants, that you are in this state of always being cold and hungry and thirsty, in a way, that's what prevents you from plumbing the depths of your situation. On page 19, on the first page of the narrative, Levy announces an iron law. He says the iron law is that man is bound to pursue his own ends by all possible means, while he who errs but once pays dearly. That within the camps is the law, which means that whenever you can skive, and whenever you can dawdle, and whenever you can take a walk that takes an hour rather than 10 minutes, you must do it. because anyone who works in the camps as hard as is demanded of them will weaken himself fatally and prepare his own death. But on page 19, Levy applies this law to life outside the camps. He says, our resistance movement was so inefficient and so ill-prepared that, in a sense, we deserved to be caught. Now, this is an example, I would say, where he's taking a law that he learns in the camps and applying it to his earlier life. It's not at all clear that that application will always necessarily work. You know, one can understand why he makes that application here, but it wouldn't actually always be the case that lapses of this kind would prove fatal. However, within the camps, those kind of lapses are practically always fatal. So it's one of those questions. How much do the rules which run within the camps apply to the world outside? I want to get at this from a different angle now in talking about the transition, about how the system of the death camps took away people's humanity and made them into what they call häftlings. This transition is the subject of chapters 1 and 2 of the book. Pages 20 to 24 are devoted, if you like, to saying goodbye to life. Levy compares the people in the transit camp on the day they are told that they will be transported to people who have been condemned to death. He suggests that in that such cases, an austere ritual is proposed. But in the case of the Jews in the camp, this ritual is not possible. This special status is not granted. And could you read the second extract from page 21?
And night came, and it was such a night that one knew that human eyes would not witness it and survive. Everyone felt this. Not one of the guards, neither Italian nor German, had the courage to come and see what men do when they know they have to die. All took leave from life in the manner which most suited them. Some praying, some deliberately drunk, others lustfully intoxicated for the last time. But the mothers stayed up to prepare the food for the journey with tender care, and washed their children and packed the luggage. And at dawn the barbed wire was full of children's washing hung out in the wind to dry. Nor did they forget the diapers, the toys, the cushions and the 100 other small things which mothers remember and which children always need. Would you not do the same? If you and your child were going to be killed tomorrow, would you not give him to eat today?
It's very telling, isn't it, the way he turns that phrase into the second person. That having described this appalling situation and the practicality with which it's faced, he turns to you and says, wouldn't you do the same? You know, wouldn't you make sure that at least your child had food for tomorrow, even if you knew that they were going to die the day after? Once he's made that point, he describes a family of Jews from Tripoli, a family which is used to being moved on from one place to another, and which brings with them always their working tools and their musical instruments. Could you read the third extract, please, Nick? Thanks.
They were happy and pious folk. Their women were the first to silently and rapidly finish the preparations for the journey in order to have time for mourning. When all was ready, the food cooked, the bundles tied together, they unloosened their hair, took off their shoes, placed the otzite candles on the ground and lit them according to the customs of their fathers, and sat on the bare soil in a circle for the lamentations, praying and weeping all the night. We collected in a group in front of their door, and we experienced within ourselves a grief that was new for us, the ancient grief of the people that has no land, the grief without hope of the exodus, which is renewed every century.
Thank you. And of course, for Levy, this is a new discovery, because Levy belongs to a sector of Jewry which is comfortably fixed in Turin. You know, after the end of the war, he'll go back and he'll carry on living in the same apartment building where he was born. He thinks of himself as much an Italian as a Jew. But here he's confronting the sort of the age-old customs of the people without a land, without a home. And of course, for him who has a home, thinking of himself in terms of being part of a race without a home is part of a kind of ingestion, if you like, in his own and his people's deep traditions. But what's described on these pages, and really I should have made the extracts longer here, is what leaving life is like. This family from Tripoli managed leaving life as a kind of ceremony, as a part of life. In the paragraphs on either side, he shows us that many of the other people weren't able to manage it in such a way. But that above all things, that when you see people getting ready to die, some are astonishingly heroic and some are not. And there's no way to predict which person will take up which of those roles. This point, the saying goodbye to life in chapters 1 and 2, is the place in the book where the tone is darkest, as though giving up life is worse when it's all so close to you. He says, we think of our homes so near in time, so near in space, and yet, as it were, we know now that all that has gone away. We know that for practical purposes, we're dead. And somehow the agony is greater at the moment of saying goodbye to life. Later, when things are objectively worse, the need to survive takes over from the need to mourn. The moment of mourning is tremendously important in this book, but it's almost part of that message that he was giving us at the beginning about the nature of limitation. This is also, I think, the place in the book where Levy is most bitter. It's often said about this book, including on the back of at least my edition, that this is a book that speaks with a gentle voice. I don't think that's always true. I think Levy tries to keep bitterness out, but I think he doesn't always manage. I think in that passage about the children, there was more than a little bitterness. But I guess the most bitter part of the book, perhaps, is on page 26. And if anything, I think actually the English translation here, which generally is brilliant, is too mild. I think the translation, to do justice to the Italian here, needs to be a bit more sarcastic. Here we are then, in the middle of page 26. This is the reason why 3-year-old Emilia died. The historical necessity of killing the children of Jews was self-demonstrative to the Germans. Emilia, daughter of Aldo Levi of Milan, was a curious, ambitious, cheerful, intelligent child. Her parents had succeeded in washing her during the journey, in the packed car, in a tub with tepid water, which the degenerate German engineer had allowed them to draw from the engine that was dragging us all to death. And now he's back on the moment where we're on the platform. Thus, in an instant, our women, our parents, our children disappeared. We saw them for a short while as an obscure mass at the other end of the platform. Then we saw nothing more. He's talking here, isn't he? He's saying to the German people, the historical necessity of killing a 3-year-old Jew was overwhelmingly true. You can't say anything, in a sense, more bitter than that. Who's this degenerate German? The degenerate German is the one who's the engine driver who's given them a bit of water to wash their baby. He's called degenerate, in a way, by the rules of a society that thinks that the civilized thing to do is to kill 3-year-old children. The second stage of the transformation, I've been talking so far about the saying goodbye to life. The second stage of the transformation is more material. You take away people's possessions. You take their clothes. You shave their hair. You tattoo a number on them. You put them in striped uniforms which don't fit, and clogs. You give them no water, and you starve them. You need a certain degree of comfort to act in a way that's suitable for human beings. The camp takes that away from you, and focuses you on the need to survive, and above all, on the need to learn the rules of the camp. Learn German, act fast, that's your chance to survive. This is the focus of one of the central chapters of the book, chapter 9, The Drowned and the Saved. This is a terrible chapter, I think, to read, but absolutely crucial to our understanding of the book. The drowned are those who die immediately, those who never learn the rules. He says they're almost not alive. We'll probably come back to this passage in a bit. The saved are those who get through. But the saved, as he describes them, are in ordinary human terms practically monsters. He says that there are, you'll have to read, there are this sort of case studies, if you like, of four characters. But in each case, he says they're people whose special gifts that enabled them to survive in effect rendered them unfit for any other kind of human contact. Chapter 9 is the chapter in which Levy tries to draw conclusions from what he calls this gigantic biological and social experiment. An experiment in which what is essential and what is adventitious to the human, in which they discover or try to discover what is essential and what is unnecessary to the human animal in the struggle for life. Okay, so we want, here we are beginning on these conclusions. And this is from page 93, when he's saying the conclusion that he's not going to drive. So here's the paragraph 3 is about the experiment, and paragraph 4 is about the conclusion which he won't draw. We do not believe in the most obvious and facile deduction, that man is fundamentally brutal, egoistic, and stupid in his conduct once every civilized institution is taken away, and that the heftling is consequently nothing but a man without inhibitions. He refuses to believe that the state of the inhabitants of the camp is, if you like, unadorned, unaccommodated human life. We believe rather that the only conclusion to be drawn is that in the face of driving necessity and physical disabilities, many social habits and instincts are reduced to silence. So he said, the things that make life more bearable, those things that we do to make each other's lives easier, those are the things that disappear in the face of extreme want. It's not that human beings are inevitably egotistical and destructive of other humans, but it's those little margins of helping others that go away in the course of this experiment. In normal life, he says, there are resources, there are safety nets, there are helps, but here there are none. And that's the point of the drowned and the saved. In most of life, there's a middle category between the drowned and the saved. But in the death camps, there's no middle category, and there's no space for that. Could you read pages 94 to 95?
In history and in life, one sometimes seems to glimpse a ferocious law which states, to he that has will be given, from he that has not will be taken away. In the Lager, where man is alone and where the struggle for life is reducible to its primordial mechanism, this unjust law is openly in force, is recognised by all. With the adaptable, the strong and astute individuals, even the leaders willingly keep contact, sometimes even friendly contact, because they hope later to perhaps derive some benefit. But with the Muslims, the men in decay, it is not even worth speaking, because one knows already that they will complain and will speak about what they used to eat at home. Even less worthwhile is it to make friends with them, because they have no distinguished acquaintances in camp. They do not gain any extra rations, they do not work in profitable commandos, and they know no secret method of organising. And in any case, one knows that they are only here on a visit, that in a few weeks nothing will remain of them but a handful of ashes in some nearby field and a crossed out number on a register.
Thank you. And you need to spend some more time with those passages, those sense of Levy himself saying that the law of the camp is that there are certain people that it's not even worth spending pity on, because the effort that you lose in pitying them or helping them will weaken yourself. And at the end, I'm going to come back to that passage because I think we can't take it in its full starkness. But for the moment, I want you to notice the ferocious law that he announced at the beginning. To he that has will be given. From he that has not will be taken away. Levy calls this an appalling law, but some of you will have noticed that that's also a passage from the Gospels. In other words, tied back into this condemnation is a kind of condemnation of what one could see as a certain heartless measure within Christianity itself. There's no other point in the book where Levy specifically condemns Christians. But, this is an axiom that you sometimes hear good Christians enunciate as part of the law. And Levy wants to say that it's appalling. Just as later on, he wants to say that some of the prayers made by his companions in the lager are appalling. He says at one point, "I hope that God spits on his prayers." That there's a sense that the prayer is so immoral that whatever religious thrust it might have is almost worse. But the conclusion here is clear, isn't it? All the ordinary prisoners die. You have to be a special case in order to survive. And he gives a number of examples of people who survive. And I've got time maybe for one example. And this is the example of the rare case of the Jewish capo, the person who is a Jew but has also become the leaders of one of these blocks. So that's on page 97, isn't it?
Is that the first one?
Yeah, the first one, please.
The Jewish prominents form a sad and notable human phenomenon. In them converge present, past, and atavistic sufferings, and the tradition of hostility towards the stranger makes of them monsters of asociality and insensitivity. They are the typical product of the structure of the German lager. If one offers a position of privilege to a few individuals in a state of slavery, exacting in exchange the betrayal of a natural solidarity with their comrades, there will certainly be someone who will accept. He will be withdrawn from the common law and will become untouchable. The more power that he is given, the more he will be consequently hateful and hated. When he is given the command of a group of unfortunates with the right of life or death over them, he will be cruel and tyrannical, because he will understand that if he is not sufficiently so, someone else, judged more suitable, will take over his post. Moreover, his capacity for hatred, unfulfilled in the direction of the oppressors, will double back beyond all reason on the oppressed. And he will only be satisfied when he has unloaded onto his underlings the injury received from above.
Thank you. So the point he makes here is a twofold point, isn't it? That you may achieve survival by being willing to become part of the system of oppression. And that surviving in that way gives you a certain kind of advantage. But it also has a kind of psychological reinforcement. That the more you hate the people above you who are untouchable, the more you exercise that hate on the people below you who are in your power. Levy says that this is part of the camp system. But in the next paragraph, he goes on to generalize the principle. He says that this is a principle of human oppression that we can find elsewhere in history.
We are aware that this is very distant from the picture that is usually given of the oppressed who unite, if not in resistance, at least in suffering. We do not deny that this may be possible when oppression does not pass a certain limit, or perhaps when the oppressor, through inexperience or magnanimity, tolerates or favours it. But we state that in our days, in all countries in which a foreign people have set foot as invaders, an analogous position of rivalry and hatred among the subjected has been brought about. And this, like many other human characteristics, can be experienced in the lager in the light of particularly cruel evidence.
Thank you. So what he's saying here then is that this particular aspect of the lager is an extension of the general law of imperialism. wherever you have a situation where one race invades and dominates another, it will choose from within the dominated some to favour, who in order to justify their position become almost more tyrannical than the imperialistic power which imposes them. Whenever, he says, one nation dominates another, something like this will happen. Again, you might want to ask yourself how much that law of the lager can be applied outside. But I would have thought that it can. I would have thought that this will go rather well with some of the other things that we might want to understand about oppression. Against the bleakness of the case studies at the end of chapter 9, of people you would never want to meet, of people you can't imagine even as free human beings, the book also features, I would say, four inspiring examples. And the first of those examples is Primo's friend, Alberto. And Alberto is described on page 63. And I suppose the point to make here is not that Alberto's virtues were created by the lager, that actually his virtues came from outside, but that they were kind of undiminished by the situation in which he finds himself. So this is page 63, the beginning of the third paragraph. Alberto is my best friend. He is only 22, 2 years younger than me, but none of us Italians have shown an equal capacity for adaptation. Alberto entered the lager with his head high and lives in here unscathed and uncorrupted. He understood before any of us that this life is war. He permitted himself no indulgences. He lost no time complaining and commiserating with himself and with others, but entered the battle from the beginning. He has the advantage of intelligence and intuition. He reasons correctly. Often he does not even reason, but is equally right. I skip a couple of sentences. He fights for his life, but still remains everybody's friend. He knows whom to corrupt, whom to avoid, whose compassion to arouse, whom to resist. And it is for this virtue of his that his memory is still dear and close to me. He himself did not become corrupt. I always saw and still see in him the rare figure of the strong and yet peace-loving man against whom the weapons of the night are blunted. There's much more on this friendship later in the novel, in the story, and particularly on their decision to share everything that they gain and discover. Alberto, in many ways, makes Primo a better person. When the guards abandon the camp, Alberto comes to the sick bay to visit Primo. Primo is too sick to move, but Alberto, on page 161, comes to say goodbye. The strong man saying goodbye to the man who is ill, perhaps to death. But of course, it was Alberto who died. 20,000 people left the camp marching. Almost all of them died. Alberto was one of them. Levy survived through luck and through the people who happened to be with him in the block of the sick bay that he was operating. So Alberto is seen, if you like, as the best person in the prison. But even for him, survival in the end isn't possible. The second of these inspiring people is Piccolo, the French boy called Jean, and he's described on page 116. Again, in another of the absolutely crucial chapters of the book, the chapter called The Canto of Ulysses. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but that's a chapter that you need to read very carefully for yourself, which I can't say enough about in this lecture. So this is on page 116. Now Jean was an exceptional piccolo. He was shrewd and physically robust, and at the same time, gentle and friendly. Although he continued his secret individual struggle against death, he did not neglect his human relationships with less privileged comrades. Notice that phrase. Everybody has to have the secret battle against death. But what marks out people like Piccolo is that he can also maintain human relationships with less privileged comrades. At the same time, he had been so able and persevering that he had been able, managed to establish himself in the confidence of Alex, the capo. I'm going to skip a couple of paragraphs. Although Jean had never abused his position, we had already been able to verify that a single word of his, said in the right tone of voice and at the right moment, had great power. Many times already, it had saved one of us from a whipping or from being denounced to the SS. Piccolo, in all sorts of ways, helps Primo to survive. But Piccolo wants to be taught Italian. And Primo hits on a canto from the Inferno of Dante, which he's going to teach Piccolo as a way of talking about it, the Italian language. And he's trying to recover as much of this poem as he can. And as you read it, you'll find out that there are all sorts of gaps in what he's able to remember. But in this section of Inferno Canto 26, Primo, by trying to explain what Dante is saying to the young Frenchman, reminds himself of what it is to be a human being and to be free, of that ceaseless desire for knowledge which Ulysses proclaims as the characteristic of human beings. But also, in Dante's sense, that there's another power, a greater power, that wills Ulysses' destruction. And in that moment, in the explanation, it's as if trying to explain the story to Piccolo, Primo begins to understand something about the logic of the situation that they're in. That there's an absolute need for freedom, but somehow something else for an inexplicable purpose has willed them a kind of unfreedom. Piccolo went on the march at the same time as Alberto, but he survived the march. And in fact, Piccolo is still alive. 2 years ago, he published a book about his experience in the camp, but most particularly also about the journey afterwards. The third figure whom Primo remembers as a kind of example in the camps is Lorenzo, the civilian worker who brings him extra food. Have you got that one, 127-8? Could you read that?
I believe that it was really due to Lorenzo that I am alive today, and not so much for his material aid as for his having constantly reminded me by his presence, by his natural and plain manner of being good, that there still existed a just world outside our own, something and someone still pure and whole, not corrupt, not savage, extraneous to hatred and terror, something difficult to define, a remote possibility of good, but for which it was worth surviving. The personages in these pages are not men. Their humanity is buried, or they themselves have buried it, under an offence received or inflicted on someone else. The evil and insane SS men, the capos, the politicals, the criminals, the prominents, great and small, down to the indifferent slave Haftlinger, all the grades of the mad hierarchy created by the Germans, paradoxically fraternized in a uniform, internal desolation. But Lorenzo was a man. His humanity was pure and uncontaminated. He was outside this world of negation. Thanks to Lorenzo, I managed not to forget that I myself was a man.
Thank you. So when we read about Lorenzo, we start to understand the meaning of the title. While he's in the prisoner in the camp, he's not fully a man, but by remembering what it is to be human, he can carry some sort of qualities which enable him not to succumb to the regime under which he's placed. The last of my four inspiring examples is a tragic one. This part of the story, again, it's something that Levy can't tell us fully because it's not something of which he has personal experience. He's a man who is somehow linked with the uprising in the sister camp of Birkenau, where one of the crematoriums was destroyed. And this man, who's been discovered to be part of this resistance, is about to be hanged in front of all his fellow prisoners. And this is page 155 to 156. Let me just give you a second to find that. It's quite a long quotation, but I think we've got time for it. It's from the middle of the page, sorry.
He is to die today before our very eyes. And perhaps the Germans do not understand that this solitary death, this man's death, which has been reserved for him, will bring him glory, not infamy. At the end of the German speech, which nobody understood, the raucous voice of before again rose up. Habt ihr verstanden? Have you understood? Who answered Jawohl? Everybody and nobody. It was as if our cursed resignation took body by itself, as if it turned into a collective voice above our heads. But everybody heard the cry of the doomed man. It pierced through the old thick barriers of inertia and submissiveness. It struck the living core of man in each of us. Kameraden, ich bin der Letz. Comrades, I am the last one. I wish I could say that from the midst of us, an abject flock, a voice rose, a murmur, a sign of assent. But nothing happened. We remained standing, bent and grey, our heads dropped, and we did not uncover our heads until the Germans ordered us to do so. The trap door opened. The body wriggled horribly. The band began playing again, and we were once more lined up and filed past the quivering body of the dying man. At the foot of the gallows, the SS watched us pass with indifferent eyes. Their work is finished, and well finished. The Russians can come now. There are no longer any strong men among us. The last one is now hanging above our heads, and as for the others, a few halters had been enough. The Russians can come now. They will only find us, the slaves, the worn out, worthy of the unarmed death which awaits us. To destroy a man is difficult, almost as difficult as to create one. It has not been easy nor quick, but you Germans have succeeded. Here we are, docile under your gaze. From our side you have nothing more to fear, no acts of violence, no words of defiance, not even a look of judgment. Alberto and I went back to the hut, and we could not look each other in the face. That man must have been tough. He must have been made of another metal than us if this condition of ours, which has broken us, could not bend him. Because we also are broken, conquered. Even if we know how to adapt ourselves, even if we have finally learnt how to find our food and to resist the fatigue and cold, even if we return home.
Again, it's very striking there, isn't it? Again, the use of the second person. You need to kind of measure those moments in the book. But in the first time, that moment of, wouldn't you do this for your children? But this time, again, that accusation. You Germans have succeeded. That sort of... So in one sense, the you was a kind of an act of imagination, of solidarity, a way of saying to people who aren't about to be sent to their deaths, you have to imagine what our life is like. This you, of course, is a you of condemnation. In a way, that's the right place to end what I have to say. But there's a few more things I want to say just very quickly. First of all, how did Primo himself survive? Well, we have to say, through good fortune, through having the right skill at one moment, through having friends, through having help, through the expertise which saved him from having to work hard through the second winter, through the luck, as it happens, of catching scarlet fever and of meeting up with some Frenchmen who still had some determination to carry out some sort of resistance. I want to end the talk, though, with two puzzles and one slightly disturbing fact. The first puzzle has to do with a figure called Steinlauf, whom he mentions on page 47. And he talks about how in his early days in the camp, He had become slovenly about his appearance and had felt that since he was going to die, what was the need to do anything properly? And he was struck by this Steiner, who insisted on washing and polishing his shoes and doing things which in themselves could exhaust him unnecessarily. And Steiner calls to Levy and he says, we're not doing this to please the Germans. We're doing this to show that we're human beings. We must polish our shoes, not because the regulation states it, but for dignity and propriety. We must walk erect without dragging our feet, not in homage to Prussian discipline, but to remain alive, not to begin to die. And when you read that paragraph, you think, okay, here is a lesson from the Lager. But what's the puzzle is, Levy doesn't really quite accept that as a lesson. This is how it goes on. These things Steinlauf, a man of goodwill, told me. Strange things to my unaccustomed ear. Understood and accepted only in part, and softened by an easier, more flexible, and blander doctrine. So at first he says, I didn't accept it in a way because I wasn't ready for it, because it didn't temperamentally suit me. But later he erects that into a sort of principle. This is at the bottom of page 47. No, the wisdom and virtue of Steinlauf, certainly good for him, is not enough for me. In the face of this complicated world, my ideas of damnation are confused. Is it really necessary to elaborate a system and put it into practice? Or would it not be better to acknowledge one's lack of a system? So one puzzle I think we need to think about, or you need to think about, what is involved in Levy's rejection of Steinlauf's ideas? What is it about what Steinlauf proposes that Levy doesn't feel quite right? And Levy makes it very clear that he doesn't think it's quite right, even though the person who's introducing the book seems to believe that Steinlauf's view is endorsed by the book. So what does it mean, that lack of endorsement of Steinlauf? What exactly is Levy holding out for in taking that position? The second puzzle goes back to that chapter of the drowned and the saved, and the awkward depiction of the people whom he calls the Musselman. And he says very firmly that it's a law of survival that you shouldn't bother with such people. The cost of survival is to let the drowned drown. And when one reads those pages, one can't help feeling that that's impossibly harsh. Of course, that's a harshness that is not of Levy's making. It's a harshness that's forced on him by the situation. And yet, of course, Levy's survival depended on people not treating him as one of the Musselmen, depended on people who didn't do this, on people who did that extra thing. So, in other words, that attitude of almost condemnation of the Musselmen, where he says they aren't even alive, you can't even call their deaths death, that doesn't seem to accord, really, with those lessons of the more heroic people in the camp. Furthermore, it's Levy's identification with these people who remain human, who extend friendship anyway. That, in a way, is what helps him remain alive and to remain a man. So it's a very awkward position there, that somehow it's the lesson of the thing that he himself can't do that brings him into a state of somehow retaining his humanity. So you might want to think about how that depiction of the Musselman, the drowned of chapter 9, how can we relate that to what he says about Alberto and Lorenzo and Piccolo? Because I think both things are true. You know, if Levy had given his loyalty to the wrong people, he certainly wouldn't have survived. That's the nature of the world that he was being placed in. Last of all, a fact. On the 11th of April, 1987, Primo Levi died by falling from the third floor landing of the apartment block that he'd lived in almost all his life. Both his British biographers and the Turin coroner interpreted this as an act of suicide. Other writers and some of his friends believe, on the contrary, that it was an accident. We can't know the truth about this. There is no suicide note. I don't want to speculate on the reasons for this, and I urge you not to, but I think you need to know that this is the case. It's possible that the cost of surviving was too great, but we have to be grateful for the luck that enabled Levy to survive. And of course, we must never forget. Primo Levi wrote of the obligation to survive and to relate what happened. He also wrote of the nightmare shared by all the prisoners, that they would come home and tell their story, and that people would fail to hear what they were saying, or would willfully ignore what the prisoner was telling them, because it was so strange and so unbearable. Now that you've read this book, you have to remember it. We owe it to our humanity not to let anything of this kind happen again. Thank you.